From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, Election Day, 3 weeks from tomorrow. Donald Trump is going to be in Green Bay, Wisconsin this evening for an event. Hillary Clinton doesn't have any public events on her calendar today.
And that's been a theme over the past 2 months. The Boston Globe analyzed the two candidates' calendars between August 1st and October 10th. Clinton made 52 public appearances compared with Donald Trump's 88. Should she be out more now combating, for instance, Trump's claims about Bill Clinton's alleged affairs, or is that impossible for her? Or is that last week's news, is the new campaign lightning rod, Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud? Let's start the hour with NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hi there.
And start with the charges of voter fraud. Ohio's Secretary of State is a Republican, John Husted. Today he flat out said, I'm in charge of elections in Ohio and they're not going to be rigged. He's calling Donald Trump irresponsible. Is Trump running the risk of insulting Republicans, many of whom run the elections in battleground states?
Yeah, I was going to say, in most of the battleground states, there are actually Republican secretaries of state who are in charge in those places. Look, the fact is, we have pretty well-run elections in our country. They're not rigged. We have a decentralized system. In other words, the federal government doesn't run the elections. States run them state by state. So for there to be collusion and for there to be a conspiracy, it would have to be broad, sweeping conspiracy that, you know, is just not – it just does not exist.
Yeah,
I mean, you have Republican poll watchers, Republican poll workers working together, lawyers who can challenge ballots. It's just not the reality in this country.
But there's a lot of dog whistles right now. Rudy Giuliani talking about the inner cities in particular. If Republicans maybe had voters in the inner cities, he said, maybe they would be trying to, you know, rig the vote as well. And it seems to be working. A Politico morning consult poll conducted last week shows 41% of voters saying the election could be stolen from Donald Trump because of voter fraud.
41% is a remarkable number of people who believe that the election could be stolen or rigged, but it's not a majority of the country. Mm-hmm. I think that what you see Donald Trump doing and what Rudy Giuliani doing are trying to turn out their base supporters, even though they know better. Donald Trump knows that if he loses, Rudy Giuliani knows that if he loses, that it would have been fair and square. But they're doing this to be able to drive out their supporters because they need each and every single one of them to turn out. And they're hoping that it's something more akin to a midterm year where Democrats have more problems turning out young voters, African-Americans, Hispanics, real pillars of the Democratic Party. And when they don't turn out, Democrats don't do well. Democrats, on the other hand, believe that the opposition to Donald Trump will fuel those voters and be at record levels.
Yeah. Well, the claims of conspiracy seem to be two-pronged. One, that there's a conspiracy at polling places to, you know, dead people vote or bus people in to vote inappropriately. But then there's claims that there's a media conspiracy. He's Donald Trump over the weekend in New Hampshire.
Instead of being held accountable, Hillary is running for president in what looks like a rigged election. Okay? It looks to me like a rigged election. The election is being rigged by corrupt media pushing completely false allegations and outright lies in an effort to elect her president.
And then his running mate, Republican vice presidential nominee Mike Pence, continued that theme talking to NBC's Chuck Todd yesterday about what he sees as more coverage of allegations against Donald Trump, of allegations of predatory behavior, than coverage of the hacked emails about Hillary Clinton.
I have to tell you, it really is astonishing to most Americans that as these unsubstantiated allegations are treated with an enormous amount of coverage on this network and other networks, that revelations coming out of Secretary of State Clinton's years in the State Department and the Clinton Foundation are virtually ignored by the national media.
Now, we should say that in that exchange with Chuck Todd, he also mentioned the New York Times reporting on Hillary Clinton. And Chuck Todd said, well, you just said the New York Times. But do they have a point, Domenico, that there is less coverage of the emails regarding Hillary Clinton?
Well, Pence also said that he would accept the outcome of the election, not something Donald Trump is doing. And we've seen Trump and Pence disagree on a couple other things that came up with Syria, for example, in the last debate. But as far as the imbalance of coverage, you know, when a candidate is accused of sexual misconduct, it's beyond some of the other things that we've seen in the WikiLeaks emails. I mean, the WikiLeaks stuff we've been covering, you could go to NPR.org and see stories on them. And they reinforce some of what we've known about Hillary Clinton, some narratives about Hillary Clinton, but certainly nothing to the level of some giant smoking gun.
Right.
Now, I would fully expect Donald Trump to try to use that and to try to deflect and use it in the debate and frame it in a way that would seem to be something completely nefarious. We haven't seen that level quite yet in these WikiLeaks emails.
Debate, by the way, Wednesday night at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. Just quickly, you said you talked about the tape and the claims against Trump. Most recent Washington Post ABC News poll shows 64% of voters say the Access Hollywood tape and Trump's reaction don't make a difference to them. Does that surprise you?
Not really. We're in a very polarized country. This is a test case of just how much so, to be perfectly honest. Mm-hmm. People have a lot of different priorities. I think that the unifying thing for a lot of Trump supporters is their animus toward Hillary Clinton. And they have other priorities when it comes to kitchen table issues, preferring a generic Republican as opposed to a generic Democrat on things like the Affordable Care Act, for example, and being against it.
NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, health officials in Florida have identified a new neighborhood where people have been infected with Zika virus. Little Haiti is the third neighborhood in the Miami area where mosquitoes have transmitted the virus to people. Public health specialists are trying to figure out the best approach to battle the Aedes aegypti mosquito. And one Miami researcher has a good lead. Carrie Barber with the Pulse at Here and Now contributor WHYY reports.
Hello, Carrie Barber. Very nice to meet you.
Matthew DeGennaro, a neurogeneticist at Florida International University, is friendly and welcoming when I visit him in his lab. He looks like a slightly hipper version of your high school science teacher in a short-sleeved plaid button-down, ready to patiently explain complex concepts. DeGennaro's lab doesn't look especially high-tech. With metal shelving and neatly labeled plastic tubs, it could be a bread baker's pantry. But looks can deceive. DeGennaro and his team are using advanced technology to cook up tools to do battle with the Aedes aegypti mosquito, the primary carrier of Zika, as well as dengue and yellow fever, and a particularly nasty virus called chikungunya.
So worldwide, approximately 725,000 people die every year because of mosquito-borne illness.
DeGennaro and his crew aren't the only team working on this problem. In fact, humans have tried for a century to exterminate Aedes aegypti with no success. But this group thinks they've found an Achilles heel of sorts in the pest that they hope to exploit.
Mosquitoes are born with the knowledge of how to find a human host. The primary way that mosquitoes find people is using their sense of smell.
The bacteria on our skin metabolizes our sweat and produces an odor that appeals mightily to female mosquitoes, the only ones that bite. DeGennaro says, think of it this way. If you're a big meat eater and you haven't eaten for a few days, then someone serves you up a delicious-smelling, perfectly cooked roast beef. And DeGennaro's team is trying to create mosquitoes that simply can't smell us. If they can't use us as a food source, they can't nourish their eggs and reproduce, and they can't spread disease. His team has a powerful tool at its disposal, a gene editing technique called clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats, or CRISPR for short.
So it's an RNA-guided way of specifically going into the genome, taking a nuclease, and then it just cleaves the gene just at one spot, and just the gene that you're interested in. So this is an amazing technique that has sort of revolutionized biology in all sorts of ways.
It takes about 6 months to create a batch of modified mosquitoes, and then it's testing time. To see whether it's working, a tester puts his arm in a box behind a screen, and other team members send in the mutant mosquitoes. The ones that are attracted bang up against the screen, trying to get to the arm. In this way, researchers can tell whether they have genetically affected the insect's sense of smell.
We are getting closer. You know, I think we're making progress, so I'm hopeful that we can use this knowledge to really deeply understand how mosquitoes smell the world, and particularly how they smell people.
The team is also using the results of its genetics experimentation on the Aedes aegypti to develop attractants and repellents to control mosquito behavior.
You can actually make a repellent by trying to make our cells invisible to them. by blocking their sense of smell with a designer perfume, we and others hope to identify such chemicals and use them to hide people from mosquitoes.
Another group using genetics to approach the Aedes aegypti problem is the British company Oxitec. They're modifying male mosquitoes so that when they mate with females, their offspring will die off almost immediately. The company's plans to test these mutants on a small island near Key West have become fodder for intense public debate. A non-binding referendum on whether the Brits can release their modified mosquitoes into the wild will appear on the November 8th ballot in the community of Key Haven, Florida. Until then, DeGennaro's lab will continue to focus on smell, and the stakes are high.
This is not about making like a redder tomato. This is about blocking a disease that is making it less safe for women to have children in Miami and across the world.
For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Barber.
Machines are going to fail, and the system's going to fail.
And then what?
Then survival. Who has the ability to survive? That's the game. Survive.
Burt Reynolds and John Voight in the 1972 film Deliverance. It is just one of the many films that Burt Reynolds has starred in over five decades. You may remember his Oscar-nominated role, a porn film director in Boogie Nights. Burt Reynolds is 80 now, and he's written a book about his life called But Enough About Me. It's out in paperback this month. I spoke with him when the book debuted last November. What a life you've had.
That's just the first chapter.
Well, okay, let's go back to the beginning, because I do want to get through a lot of this. But you talk about something that I didn't know about, which was that you were in a car crash when you were a sophomore in college. You almost died.
Yes, it was a horrible accident. It was some guys were stealing cement blocks, and they had this truck out across the road. And I couldn't see it, and I was driving my usual over the limit and drove right underneath it, and it fell on me on top of the car. They didn't have the bars of whatever they're called they get you out with in those
days. Jaws of life.
That's right, the jaws of life. So they were digging me out, and of course I knew all the policemen because of my dad. And I heard this voice I knew was a guy named Clark Bibler. And I said, Clark. And he said, is that you, buddy? And I said, listen, don't tell my dad. The car looked like a peanut. I mean, it was so crushed up. I think my dad would have known. But it took him about an hour and a half to get me out. And when I stood up, I coughed and blood went everywhere. And I had busted my spleen and a lot of other things.
You thought you were going to die. I mean,
yes,
when it happened. You described, you know, seeing the light before deciding you didn't want to go through with that.
Yes. And I kept saying, you've had a fantastic life, you've had a fantastic life. And then somewhere a voice said, well, it wasn't that fantastic. You don't have to you don't have to cash in.
Do you think about that still today? Have you, over the course of your career, do you think about the fact that, you know, but for luck in a certain way, you wouldn't even be there to do all the things that you did?
Oh, yes, I do. I think of it a lot. And I'll never forget the only doctor, we'd never had a doctor, we didn't have a family doctor, was the football doctor. And he had, just a week before, he had taken a spleen out of a young man, saved his life. Huh. So he looked at me, and he was, I remember he was looking at my fingernails for some reason, and he said, prep this boy, he's dying. And then it was like one of those bad movies where you're on the stretcher and you see the lights going past you as they're wheeling you as fast as they can to the operating room. That was the night before Christmas. And 2 days later, I was at the beach.
Wow.
Walking around.
Wow. let's talk about the film that many people probably know you for. It's the film that you said if I had to put only one film in a time capsule, it would be this one, and that would be the 1972 film Deliverance. Why did you say that that would be the film that you would want to put in a time capsule?
I felt that was a daring film, number one. John Borman was the best director I've ever had. And my best friend, John Voight, he was wonderful to me.
And do you think that the reason that that you didn't get an Oscar for that was because, as you say in the book, I don't know whether you're kidding or not about this, but was because you had done this nude photo shoot in Cosmopolitan right before that?
I think it hurt the film in general. As far as me, it was a stupid thing. Helen Gurley Brown, who was an amazing woman and could talk you into anything, talked me into it. I didn't want to do it. I said no about 20 times. But there you are.
You also said no about 20 times to doing the film Boogie Nights in 1997.
I did that, yes.
Why?
Because I'm stupid. I had so much trepidation about that film. I thought it was a very daring film, and that wouldn't hold me back. But I thought it was really stepping into territory that hadn't been touched on film. And the character I was playing was really a seedy kind of guy. And a lot of those guys came around, and they were seedier than I ever had any thought of playing. And I thought it was a good performance. I had no idea that anyone would think it was as good as it was, but it got fantastic reviews and did very well.
You come into my house, my party, to tell me about the future. That the future is tape, videotape, and not film. That it's amateurs and not professionals. I'm a filmmaker. That's why I will never make a movie on videotape.
Now, you say you've never seen the whole thing.
Never.
No.
Why?
I was in the theater, and there came a time when I thought I got to get out of here. Now, looking back on it, I probably could look at it all the way through now, but I was, I don't know, I was afraid, truthfully.
It's interesting you say that because as I'm reading about your life, and you're somebody who has had a lot of relationships with a lot of different women, you've lived your life to the fullest, and yet it almost seems like this movie was a little too risque for you.
I thought it was. I thought it was something that you couldn't recover from.
This book is called But Enough About Me. You certainly do talk a lot about some of the people, some of the incredible people that you've known throughout your life, people that we know of. And I want to just throw a few names at you and have you tell me just a thing or two about them, because there's so many interesting ones in here, people that you mention in the book. Dinah Shore.
The kindest, most honest, most wonderful woman I ever knew. And if I have any class at all, it's because of her.
What about Sally Field?
Well, I was in love with her, and it wasn't reciprocated. She liked me, but she didn't love me the way I loved her. And it was one of those experiences that men should have so they get a better appreciation of how we treat women.
Hillary Clinton comes up in this book.
I had a lot of fun with her. I knew her husband really well. I thought he was terrific and fun. And she asked me to go to a couple of football games with her high school. So I did, and we had a good time together.
What about Donald Trump?
Well, I like Donald. I mean, I don't want to burst people's bubbles, but I like him. He was kind to me. I'm not sure about the presidency, but I'm pretty sure about him as a friend.
Johnny Carson?
The best. The best. There'll never, ever be anybody that good.
Hmm. At the end of this book, you make some claims that I have no reason to doubt that they're true, but they're pretty impressive if so, which are things like you turned down the role of Han Solo in one of the Star Wars movies?
I did.
Wow.
Brilliant move on my part, I thought.
And also Richard Gere's role in Pretty Woman.
Another brilliant move on my part. I shouldn't have been allowed. I should have had an agent that was strong enough to tell me, you're an idiot and you've got to do these films. But I didn't have.
Why'd you want to write this book right now?
I thought it was time. I'm getting up there in age, and nobody else is going to do it and not do it right, not get all the people in there. And nobody really knew the people that had been so kind to me over the years.
And what do you want people to know? If there's a young actor listening to this in Jupiter, Florida, what would you say to them?
Do everything possible to be on the stage or on the screen. You learn more from doing a bad film sometimes than you do a good one. And I think I should know an awful lot by now.
And don't turn down Han Solo if it's ever offered to you.
No, don't do that. And my life would be so different now. I hope we'd still be talking on the radio, because you'd still be a big star on radio, but I probably wouldn't be here.
Well, Burt Reynolds, the book is called But Enough About Me, A Memoir. It's a wonderful read. It's great to know all of this about you. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. You've been very kind, and I enjoyed it.
We spoke last November. The book's out in paperback this month.
As we prepare to elect a new president for the next 4 years, should we also prepare for a recession? A new survey from the Wall Street Journal finds that economists think there's a 60% chance we'll have a recession during that period. That's not good news, but is it kind of on schedule? So says Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And I don't think we should assume that everybody knows. Recession sounds like a bad thing, but just the thumbnail, what is it?
Well, economies move in two basic cycles. They go from the bottom up to the top. That's called an expansion. And when they go from the top back down, that's called a contraction or a recession.
Right. So it would be just a kind of a lag in the economy. And we're reading elsewhere, Wall Street Journal again says there's going to be two things that could happen. Either the next president will face a recession or the U.S. will have the longest economic expansion in its history. We are in an expansion.
Right. And it doesn't feel that way. So let's get some of the stats right down. There's actually a committee that tracks this at the National Bureau of Economic Research. It has its own name, the Business Cycle Dating Committee.
I know it sounds like a dating service, but it's
exactly
not.
It's very similar to any J-Date type services. Anyway, so what they do is they look at a lot of different indicators of the economy. And in retrospect, they don't do it in live time. They say, here's when the expansion begins and ends. And here's when the recession begins and ends. So if you look at this current expansion, it actually began, according to NBER, in July of 2009. Now, that's kind of weird because I bet in July 2009, no one felt like, oh, the recession's over.
Right.
But, at that time, things started to turn. And so now it's lasted 87 months through September. Just want to put that in perspective. Post-World War II average, 58 months. So I think that's why a lot of these economists are saying, hey, this is a pretty long recession here, expansion. Mm-hmm. So maybe things are going to turn.
And contract just a little bit. And it would be unprecedented if there would not be a recession in the next 4 years.
The last three expansions, which if you go back 1982 to 1990, 1991 to 2001, and then 2001 to 2007, those are actually pretty long expansions. They are on average about 95 months. So again, if we're in the 88th month right now, to think that we go even through next year, we're kind of without having a recession, we're at the long end of this. So it's, again, part of the natural business cycle. they don't all have to be as severe as the one we just had, of course.
And you said something important. You said a lot of people didn't feel like this is the longest expansion. Is that because we came back from such a terrible recession? You know, it was the housing collapse and everything. Or is it because somehow we're not getting the message out? Or is it because people in certain quarters aren't feeling it? What's going on there?
I think there's a few things going. You're absolutely right that it was a horrible recession. In fact, it was the longest recession in the entire world post-World War II era. Hmm. Okay, so that's pretty intense. And it was a very deep recession. You're also correct in saying that there are some areas that are just not coming back as quickly as others. And it sometimes it's geographic, sometimes it's industry-wide. Mm-hmm. The other piece is that when we have the type of recession we just had, it's called a balance sheet recession, where it's just too much borrowing and lending going on. They tend to have extraordinarily slow recoveries. And so I think part of it is that it's just been a pretty pokey one. Don't worry, though. You'll live through many more recessions, I promise.
It's part of the whole plan. Jill Schlesinger with CBS News. Thanks so much.
Take care.
One topic that hasn't gotten a lot of attention during the presidential campaign is North Korea, which our next guest says could be the biggest threat to U.S. national security. Joining us is retired Admiral James Stavridis, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO and Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He was vetted as a potential vice presidential candidate by the Clinton campaign. Admiral Stavridis, welcome back to Here and Now.
Great to be with you again, Jeremy.
And why do you think that North Korea is the biggest threat to U.S. national security right now?
Yeah, I often say they're the most dangerous country in the world. And the reason is, as always, leadership. The leader of North Korea is very young, unstable, morbidly obese, probably addicted to opioids, and has murdered the next tier of leadership in a ruthless manner since taking over. So that's point A. And point B is he's already got nuclear weapons. We spent a lot of time this past year worrying about Iran's possible acquisition of nuclear weapons. Here's a nation that has at least half a dozen right now. So that's a very bad combination.
What do you make of the U.S. policy toward North Korea up until this point?
I think we've been adrift. We have not staked out a great deal of sanctions, coalitions that we should be building against North Korea. And frankly, it's understandable given the press of other issues around the world, including most obviously what's happening in Syria, but also Ukraine, the invasion and annexation of Crimea, other events in Asia, including the South China Sea. All of this distracts us. But looming in the background is a very dangerous regime with a fistful of nuclear weapons. We ought to be paying more attention.
And often here in the U.S., talk of North Korea quickly turns to China. Let's listen here to Donald Trump during the first presidential debate responding to a question about nuclear weapons.
We have to be prepared. I can't take anything off the table because you look at some of these countries, you look at North Korea, we're doing nothing there. China should solve that problem for us. China should go into North Korea. China is totally powerful as it relates to North Korea.
First of all, Admiral, what do you make of that answer?
I think it's extremely simplistic and not functional. We can't simply wave our hands, walk away from North Korea, and claim that this is somehow a Chinese problem to solve. There is a grain of truth in it, which is that China has a great deal of influence over the North Korean regime because they're effectively the economic lifeline for Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea. So it's accurate to say China has to be a big part of the solution, but it's foolish to think that China in and of itself is going to solve that problem for us. It's going to require an international coalition. China will be a part of it, but collectively as a global society, we have to address this.
Isn't that what has been happening, though, up until now, an international coalition with China as a key part of it?
What has been happening up to now has been a ratcheting up of economic sanctions. What's new is the miniaturization of these nuclear weapons, the ability to deliver them at range on ballistic missiles, and now the fifth nuclear test. So we're in a new zone, which is going to require not only the economic sanctions, but I would argue also a significant effort in the cyber world to try and neutralize his progress, as well as building real military plans that are capable of reaching into that regime and blunting their ability to use these weapons. And that ranges from ballistic missile defense to offensive weapons. You see just over the last couple of days, a U.S. nuclear aircraft carrier on patrol nearby. So we're at a new stage. We're trending where we need to be. But I think this one is going to strongly be on the desk of the next president.
We also heard from Hillary Clinton's vice presidential candidate, Senator Tim Kaine, about North Korea. He was asked about it during the vice presidential debate by moderator Elaine Quijano. Let's listen.
Senator Kaine, if you had intelligence that North Korea was about to launch a missile, a nuclear-armed missile capable of reaching the United States, would you take preemptive action?
If a president should take action to defend the United States against imminent threat. You have to. The president has to do that. Now, exactly what action? You would have to determine what your intelligence was, how certain you were of that intelligence, but you would have to take action.
What do you make of that answer, and how likely, in your view, is a scenario like the one that was described by Elaine Quijano?
I believe the answer is absolutely correct, which is any nation under international law, and as you mentioned, I'm the dean of a graduate school of international law. We spend a lot of time thinking about this. Any nation that faces an imminent threat does not have to wait until an actual hostile act occurs. A nation can preemptively strike when given evidence of hostile intent. Senator Kaine is exactly right that the decision for the president would turn on the quality of intelligence. Well, as we all know, we had faulty intelligence that led us into an invasion of Iraq. In this case, I think that the broad spectrum of what we're seeing, the knowledge we have that the weapons are in place, the ability to deliver them at range, all of that would be backdrop. And if added to that were credible intelligence that we could substantiate, I think you would launch a preemptive strike against, in my view, both the nuclear weapon and the regime.
And what do you think the response would be if the U.S. were to do that?
Unfortunately, the reaction would be a lashing out of the North Korean military against South Korea. And that is complex for the United States because we still have 30,000 troops on the Korean Peninsula with our allies as a deterrent against such North Korean action. So unfortunately, Jeremy, I think we'd be in for a short, sharp conflict on the Korean Peninsula. I'm confident South Korea and the United States would easily surmount North Korea, but unfortunately, this would lead us down a path with thousands of deaths. So let's hope that we can move forward on a sanctions regime. Let's hope that China will be part of the solution, but let's be prepared in case those kind of measures are not successful.
What do you think is at stake in this election from a national security standpoint?
Well, broadly speaking, you're presented with two very different visions of the role of the United States in the world. The Trump vision, as best I can understand it, involves building a wall with Mexico, high tariff barriers with many nations, including China, encouraging Japan and South Korea to arm themselves with nuclear weapons, and a very close relationship with Vladimir Putin, who supports a war criminal dictator in Syria. That's kind of one vision. On the other side, with President Clinton, you see someone who's been a Secretary of State, operated at the highest levels of government, and has built a campaign around the idea of international coalitions, better interagency cooperation, private-public partnerships, and effective strategic communication. One is a vision to come home and build a kind of isolated fortress America, I suppose, and the other is to continue to be a global leader. I think it's a pretty straightforward choice in terms of foreign policy options.
I want to ask you one more thing while we have you, Admiral, and that is the U.S. destroyer USS Mason has come under attack from missiles several times over the past week or so off the coast of Yemen. There haven't been any injuries, but what do you think of that? Is that a wake-up call, or how should the U.S. respond?
Well, the reason those missiles were fired is they came from a group of insurgents who are supported strongly by Iran. So the wake-up call is that the Iranians will continue to support insurgencies as they are in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and in Yemen, which are seeking to attack Sunni Arab states that are allies of the United States. And so the United States should not be intimidated, should continue to operate. That destroyer, USS Mason, and I commanded a similar destroyer, USS Barry, some years ago, was operating in international waters and responded effectively to the C-802 missile that was fired at it. But we need to realize there's going to be real risk for the United States in being engaged. But it's imperative that we continue to do so. If we don't, we will cede this space to the Iranians, the Russians, the Syrians, in the case of the Levant, for example. That's not the place we want to be as a nation.
That's Admiral James Stavridis, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO and Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Admiral, thank you so much, as always.
Pleasure to be with you, Jeremy. Bye-bye.
The so-called Bridgegate trial enters its fifth week in New Jersey today, Bridgegate being the 2013 shutdown of several lanes on the George Washington Bridge, which connects Fort Lee, New Jersey with Manhattan. There were horrendous traffic jams for days. The defendants have been accused of ordering the lane closures to punish the Democratic mayor of Fort Lee for not endorsing New Jersey's Republican Governor Chris Christie in his bid for re-election. They have pled not guilty. Christie said he had no knowledge or involvement. On the stand today, Bill Baroni, a former executive with the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. He and Bridget Kelly, Christie's former deputy of staff, chief of staff, rather, are facing conspiracy and fraud charges. Andrea Bernstein, senior editor for Politics and Policy at WNYC, is following this trial. And Andrea, just remind us what these two allies of Governor Christie are accused of.
Well, they're accused of violating the civil rights of the people of Fort Lee to move freely, conspiracy and mail fraud. So those are the specific charges. But in general, they're charged with using government resources to force a Democratic mayor or to punish him for not endorsing Chris Christie in his reelection campaign. And the bigger picture behind that is that Christie was getting ready to run for president, and he wanted to ring up the biggest margin he possibly could by getting as much support as he possibly could from Democrats. And what's come out at trial is that this was part of a carrot and stick approach that he had to Democratic mayors to get them to go along with him so that he could, and in fact he did, win 60% of the vote in a blue state in his reelection campaign.
Well, last month, the former Port Authority official David Wildstein pled guilty to carrying out this scheme. He claimed it. What did he say at the time about Bill Baroni, his replacement, who's on the stand now? And what does Bill Baroni say about his knowledge of what David Wildstein did?
Right. So this is really interesting. David Wildstein testified for 8 days, and he has pleaded guilty. He faces 15 years in jail himself, although he can get leniency if the prosecutors are happy with his testimony. And he said that he was basically told to do this by the two defendants. But he also testified to a whole bunch of things, including that he discussed it with Chris Christie while it was occurring, that he had discussed it with the chairman of the Port Authority, and that he had discussed it with Christie's campaign chairman. So he spun out a wide web of knowledge about this, going right up to, if he's to be believed, the governor of the state of New Jersey. So David Wildstein, the mastermind, said that it was Bridget Kelly, one of the defendants, and Bill Baroni, one of the defendants, who he viewed as his bosses. And what Bill Baroni has been on the stand saying today is, no, it was Wildstein who had the direct connection to Governor Christie. It was Wildstein who was telling me what to do, and he kept enough of the facts hidden, Baroni testified, so that he wasn't aware of the full punitive nature of the scheme.
So it sounds like a lot of finger pointing, a lot of people trying to, you know, put the blame on others, a lot of he said, he said.
Well, yes, except that there is an awful lot of evidence. It's one thing is clear. The two defendants in this case almost never spoke to each other and never met. they spoke almost entirely through David Wildstein. So while a lot of what David Wildstein was saying rang true, there were definitely points at which he was downplaying his own agency. And, you know, let's not forget that we are talking about the man, and when I say the man, I say Chris Christie, who is the chairman of Donald Trump's transition effort. So he is right now putting together a list of who he'd like to see hired in a potential Trump administration. And these are some of the most senior officials in the Christie administration who have either pleaded guilty or accused of federal crimes.
Or accusing each other of crimes. Well, and we understand that there's been a separate judge, a municipal court judge, who's found that there's probable cause to move forward with a criminal misconduct complaint against Christie in connection with the lane closures.
Right. That's right. So this is a citizen complaint that was brought based on David Wildstein's testimony that he told Christie about the lane closures while they were occurring and that Christie did not do anything to stop them.
In fact, he laughed, is what Wildstein says.
Yeah. That is what Wildstein said, that Christie laughed when he heard about it and then when he heard that the mayor of Fort Lee wasn't getting his phone calls returned. So a citizen activist brought this to a local judge in New Jersey, and he brought the transcript of the testimony, and the judge read the testimony, and he said the sworn testimony of a federal witness is enough to find probable cause for me to sign a criminal complaint. And that is what he did. The defense attorneys in New Jersey told me that this is very unusual. But what happens now is that it goes to a local prosecutor who can decide whether to charge Christie for criminal official misconduct, but that prosecutor was appointed by Chris Christie.
Oh, so that's got there's a little tangled web there as well. Andrea Bernstein, senior editor for politics and policy at WNYC, following the Bridgegate trial and another one that may be shaping up. We don't know. Andrea, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.